You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF. I think you're all really excited to not hear from me, but to hear from Anna Sale and Gabrielle Union.
Gabrielle Union is here.
Hi.
Guys.
Hi, guys. Hi.
I am Anna Sale. I host a podcast called Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC Studios. It's about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. So I cannot imagine a more perfect person to talk to than Gabrielle Union. Thank you for being here.
No, thanks for having me.
I want to start by asking about this moment in your life right now. You're turning 45 on Sunday.
Yeah.
You have written a book that is profoundly honest about your family and growing up, about the family you've made, the boys you're raising, about trauma you've survived, about the life you've built. Spending a week so far on book tour, taking questions about these moments in your life, as you're turning 45, how are you feeling about your 45 years?
Oh, the 45 part, that's good. I feel so solid. I've never felt more whole and healed and connected and present and beautiful and powerful. And legit, I've never been more in demand in my entire career than I have been at this moment in time. That is great. in the last week since the book has been released, in the midst of the cultural shift that I believe that we are having, I was very nervous that the Harvey Weinstein scandal was the tip of an iceberg that would somehow melt away and it wouldn't signal the sign of a greater shift. But I think what we are seeing and what we will continue to see is you might as well get used to it. I cuss. We are fucking fed up and we've had enough. And so in this week, there has been so many disclosures of the most horrific abuse and pain. People have legit been suffering in silence. And all of these factors coming together have made people reach out. And it's awful to say it's nice to have this community of people who are finally sharing their pain. But it is nice to know that I'm not alone. I'm not on an island. I'm not, sometimes you feel like a helium balloon sort of drifting off and nobody's trying to catch you. I just feel finally very connected and rooted. And okay.
Good.
Yeah.
Because.
Thank you for yes. Thank you for that.
You also write about growing up a young black girl in Pleasanton, California, who's from Pleasanton, not far from here.
Hey, P-Town.
And the experience of trying to figure out where you fit growing up a black girl in Pleasanton, California.
Yeah.
You also spent summers in Omaha, Nebraska, visiting your grandmother, mm-hmm. where you were in a community surrounded primarily by black people, and you would go back and forth between these two places. When you would come back to Pleasanton after spending a summer in Omaha, how would you feel about your blackness?
In the beginning, it felt like I was an animal that just got put on display at the zoo. It felt like I was starting over again when I was much younger. As I got older and I finally had crushes that like where the love was returned, I'm like, me? You know, in Pleasanton, I was not an option. I wasn't, you're invisible at a time you want to be seen.
You describe, you were seen as a eunuch.
Yes.
You described.
I was a eunuch.
That's your word.
I was the friend. Let me tell you how much I love your best friend. And I'm like, really? No? Okay. No, it's fine. But in Omaha, I started becoming an option. I started being seen. And so the reentry period, as I got older, I became very angry at having to conform and shapeshift and be invisible again. Because once you've had a taste of attention that you've been craving, especially male attention, for a girl that had very low self-esteem, to go back to being invisible, to go back to being voiceless, to go back to being the one that is supposed to feel special when they say, oh, you know, there's niggers and then there's black people. You're one of the good black people. And you're supposed to be like, yeah, sure. You know, I resented being the special magical Negro. I hated it. My girlfriends are here from that I grew up with out in Pleasanton. And we were talking about, you know, in my yearbook, I would write the most vile crap on people's over people's pictures. And I found my yearbook, you know, this summer. And I was like, I was so angry. Mm. Like, I was literally like, I bitch. Like, who hurt you? You were 11. Like, but I... But in thinking back, and now as an adult, sort of, you know, with revisionist history, of course, but I was angry at a much earlier age than I think I was prepared to admit. My parents, of course, they thought moving us to Pleasanton was giving us all of the opportunity. You know, you great schools, safe neighborhoods, you know, you're going to be around the right kind of people. And all it did was isolate us. Hmm. We were immediately othered, and nobody wants to be othered. And you realize the force of assimilation is incredibly great. Whether that been, you know, trying to relax my hair, trying to minimize my, there's a whole series of pictures where I'm like this, doing this. Hmm. Thinking that this was attractive, looking like Fire Marshal Bill. you know, or, you know, legit trying to leave the relaxer on my hair, like, I guess, you know, long enough to turn white. But where I would end up with lesions, you know. So the whole goal was the European, you know, Eurocentric beauty ideal. But you know what's not sexy? Lesions. So it's like at every turn, they were like, no, never you. Stop. It's never going to be you. You will always be othered. You're always going to be just the friend. You're never going to, I always talk about that high school dances. There's that moment when the fast songs, you know, are on. And you're like, okay, I'm happy, magical Negro. And then the slow song comes on and there's that 30 seconds of like, anybody? And then you suddenly have to come up with an excuse for why, like, no one's asked you to dance. I was thirsty. I'm so hot. So hot. I have to go outside. I wasn't fucking hot. You know what I mean? I was just hoping for a pity dance to Bryan Adams. No one wants to be in heaven with me. No one's summer of 69 and I, 68, I owe you one something. No one. Yeah.
But I also love that you talk honestly about when you're in Omaha and surrounded by black people, mm-hmm. there was a lot you had to learn.
About what
it was to be black. You wrote, I could hold my own talking about New Edition, but I felt real green on being black.
Yes.
What did you learn in those summers about being black?
Well, I realized that not having a cable package in Pleasanton that offered BET, not living in a community that had, you know, bookstores that offered black magazines, literally I would only see blackness, you know, a couple of times a month when I would go to my cousin's hair salon in Oakland. That was when she really made it. Her first salon was in Stockton, and then she moved up off Telegraph in Oakland, and she had an amazing salon. But yeah, that was literally the only glimpses. And randomly, you'd see Janet Jackson on Different Strokes. And then Vivica Fox was the Popcorn King's daughter on 90210. I don't know if you guys remember that. Huh. But I literally just never saw myself. So when I got to Omaha, I was like, what is this? What is this hairstyle? It's like those two sisters. I believe they're sisters. They talk about pushing it, I think. I'm not sure because I don't have BET.
They talk about pushing
it. I didn't know anything about hairstyles, like, and West Coast, hip hop is very West Coast. So Nas, Rakim, I was learning. I was, those summers in Omaha. It's weird to think I had to go to Omaha to learn how to be black, but home of Malcolm X, we all start somewhere. I just absorbed. My cousins became like my own personal encyclopedia to blackness. And they were so unapologetically proud and fly, and they just had zero fucks to give. And I wanted that because I had all the fucks. Like, they're like, oh, you have a fuck to give? No, please put it in my fucks to give basket, because my basket is quite full. I'm very nervous, I wanted a taste of that, like where you're like, whatever. I needed that independence. I needed that freedom. Whereas I was completely committed to assimilation, they had completely rejected it and looked like they were having a great time. Mm.
It was also, coming in one summer at a time, then leaving, you could see how Omaha was changing.
Yes.
When you were a teenager.
Yes.
And you write about being able to see crack show up and gang violence show up. And at first it was sort of playing gang, and then the next summer, friends of yours were shooting and getting shot.
Yeah, people were dead.
Did you feel safe?
Yeah, no, totally.
How did you?
It's weird. It's bizarre because I was with my family. If in Pleasanton there was, well, I don't know if it's still the fear of going over the hill. Like, over the hill is like Narnia, it's Middle Earth, and there was this fear of either going over the hill or people from over the hill coming into Pleasanton. I mean, I remember when they were building BART into Pleasanton, and there were all, Rachel's laughing because she was like, people's parents were like, they're coming! All of the brown people are coming to Stone Ridge Mall! They're gonna take over Mrs. Fields cookies! I'm not exactly sure what people thought was gonna happen, but there was a lot of fear of coming over the hill. So if I were to be in Pleasanton, the idea of violence happening or crime would be like terror. It would be like, Pennywise, like, is like lurking around every corner. But in Omaha, no, I always felt safe. If something popped off, it was like you might duck behind a car, but then it was like, and then you hang again. I didn't feel terror. Because blackness wasn't weaponized and demonized and deemed inherently threatening,
Yeah. And then you'd come back to high school.
And they'd be like, you survived.
Yeah.
What happened with all of them?
How important were sports in Pleasanton in finding a place to belong?
Well, I was very talented at basketball, but a part of me hated that I was talented at basketball because it felt like a little cliche. I loved being good at soccer because then it wasn't I didn't feel like a stereotype. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't play sports in Pleasanton, there were a crew of band people that they called unfortunate names that we will not repeat. Sorry, band people. But then otherwise, it was soccer, soccer and football, baseball. That's how you socialized. You split up into, your different factions of sports. But it was everything. Pleasanton is defined by sports and subtivisions.
And
or at least it was in 91. I'm not sure how it's evolved. I hope it has evolved.
And basketball camps?
Basketball camp is where I had a very good time at basketball.
Well, you write about a young man, mm-hmm, who was interested in you, and his compliment to you was, "You're like a white girl without the hassle."
Yes.
And this is a black kid?
That was supposed to be a compliment.
Yeah.
And I took it as one, not understanding. Yeah.
What did you hear in that moment, and what do you hear now?
In the moment, I felt chosen. Mm-hmm. And I thought I might get lucky. So, chosen again. I was the girl that was like, "I'll suck your dick! Anybody! Any of them! Anybody! Anybody? Anybody? Nope! Nope!" Still the friend. It's fine. Circle back. It's fine. He could have said, Ghibli goo, and I would have been like, "Great!" I just wanted to be chosen so badly, and for him to say that now, when I hear it, it felt like for him, I got this completely assimilated good girl from the right side of the tracks who speaks a certain way, who lives, I don't know how he thought I lived because he'd never seen my house, but that you had all the perks of a white girl, but you didn't have to deal with interracial dating. Whatever you think that means, or black guys mean when they say that, but I didn't care. He could have been like, "Your mama," like, I don't. He was a dream. He was a vision. He could have had a club foot. I don't know. He chose me.
When you think about your teenage self learning about men and sex, what do you wish you could tell yourself? Thinking about yourself in high school.
That you don't have wolf pussy. Vaginas come in all shapes, sizes, colors, you know. And they're all amazing. They're all flowers. Various states of blooming. But that what you're going through is not unique. Everyone else is experiencing the same thing, no matter what kind of bravado they are putting forth. But I would have said, learn where your, learn the difference between your clitoris and your vagina. probably in the health class where they discuss it. That might be a good start. But also know that you're not just a vessel for male sexual gratification. You're not a disposable mouth or orifice. That you should have every expectation of enjoying sex as well. And you should communicate what you like and don't like. You don't have to just take it because someone has chosen you in this moment. That you have agency over your body and over your own sexuality. That you don't have to accept the sexuality that some random dude who probably had a club foot puts on you, you know, that he saw, you know, in some old, you know, porno on, you know, VHS porn, you know. I had a lot of fear, not so much of the act itself, but that I was somehow being othered in the sex act. So this fear of, like, everyone else being really good at it, like, in the book I talk about, now I forget what I changed her name to. I was about to say her real name.
She could be here.
But there was this like rumor that she would ride guys and reach back and play with their balls. And I was like, like, you know, as a teenager, like, to have the confidence to ride somebody, that's a whole other thing. Much less to, like, then be like, "And I'm going to play, do the old reach around." You know, and then it's like, and what does it even mean to play with someone's balls? Like, what does that mean? I mean, I wouldn't have known. I don't, now I'm trying to remember if I included it in the book. There was an unfortunate incident at a party, again, where you feel like as long as someone chooses you, whatever they want, you go along with. And Billy, I remember that name that I changed it to, Billy, you know, wanted me to, you know, go down on him. And it was the first time. And we weren't really talking about it exactly. The Fast Times at Ridgemont High had the scene where she was sort of showing, Phoebe Cates was showing Jennifer Jason Leigh how to, you know, like, you know, give head on, well, I don't remember what kind of fruit or vegetable it was, but, you know, she was showing her, but they never mentioned anything about teeth. And so.
Live and learn. Live and learn.
And I didn't take the precautions to sort of cover those. And cut to, blah, 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 cut to, he walks down the stairs at this party singing, "Just a nibble on my dick like a rat does cheese." So again, for the person with low self-esteem, who was very nervous about being othered and not knowing what the hell they were doing, you know, that particular Two Live Crew song, to be serenaded with that, was a little jarring.
Yeah.
And confirmed all of my suspicions that I probably do have wolf pussy, and clearly my mouth is like, you know, a trap. Snareman.
Along,
penises.
Sticking with the wolf metaphor.
Yes.
So you're learning about sex. You're learning about what feels comfortable for you to do, what feels comfortable to be done to you as you're a teenager. And then you're 19, the summer after your first year of college, and you're at work. You write about this in the book in detail. You write about a man coming in near closing time with a gun to rob the store, taking you and your coworker to the back, and he asks you to take your clothes off at gunpoint, and he rapes you, and you press charges. So I want just to...
Well, you know what's interesting? I didn't. It was just done, which is, it's interesting because I guess, I'm assuming because it was a stranger rape, it wasn't something that anyone asked if I wanted. It was just, they just, you know, assumed.
They assumed you were a victim.
Yeah.
They let you be a victim.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when you think about just those first hours, what you write about is seeing your parents' faces, and you have a sentence that you, on your father's face, you saw he thought we were priced out of this shit. What was that? What does that mean?
Well, you move your black kids to Pleasanton to be different, to have the American dream, to show everyone that we are keeping up. Not only are we keeping up with the Joneses, we've shot past the Johnsons. And you think, if I just raise my daughters in this idyllic community with all of these white people doing, you know, going to the right Catholic church, you know, if she's in sports, if she's a leader, I have basically insulated my family from pain, from harm, from violence, from life, from the other side of the hill. And his face was I failed.
You failed.
He failed. I somehow failed. I don't know if he quite understood everything that had happened. I mean, obviously later he did, but that first moment, it was, what the fuck did you do? What the fuck did I do to get here? This doesn't happen to us. This doesn't happen to good people.
You, at one point, took the gun that he was aiming at you, and you shot at him. How do you feel about guns?
On that day?
Yeah.
Great. Great. On that day. But, you know, when they say, you know, had she been armed with a gun, I would have shot myself, probably. In that moment when it was me or you, and motherfucker ain't gonna be me, not today. So I'm going to try to, you know, take you out if I can in that moment. So, in you know, when if it's between me and you, and a gun can save or save my life or end yours, in that moment, that gun is a gift. Later, when I thought about gun ownership, mixed with my post-traumatic stress syndrome, those things don't make good for a good symbiotic relationship. That is a recipe for disaster. Watching how guns have taken out so many people that I know and so many people that I don't know, how many families have been ripped apart. Obviously we don't have enough gun control in this country. My husband, I don't talk about it in this book, but you know, my husband's cousin, you know, was walking her kids to school, to enroll them in school in Chicago, when she was murdered by a kid who had gone to my husband's mother's church. And we go to the funeral, and there were so many people that were just numb. For more than a few, it had been their second, third funeral that month. And when you recognize our communities are, especially our communities of color, are getting numb, the loss of life is, it's like a, you know, when you get the pollen count, it's like, my allergies are going to be acting up today. Mm. You make some adjustments. It's how it's been so normalized in so many of our communities. And then you see this current leadership. I draw a parallel. It feels like genocide. Mm. A very purposeful elimination.
Mm. You say numb, and you said that first year after you were raped, you didn't leave the house unless you were going to therapy or going to court. How did you start to feel? What was the process of feeling safe going out in public like?
Well, there's physically safe, which it started with, you know, I didn't want to go anywhere that could be robbed. Which eliminates, a lot of places that you go exchange money. Most places can be robbed. So just figuring out where was a safe space. Libraries. Turns out my love of books came in handy. Going to restaurants, not sitting with my back to the door, always having an exit route. If there's a takeover robbery right now, how will I escape? You know, always running through that mentally in my head. And then that sort of gave way to making lists. So if I left the house, I would have a list, and I would try to check it off, and I would try to get through that list as fast as possible and home. I felt like if I could just be efficient, if I could manage the clock, I could eliminate the time where something terrible could happen to me. Eventually, that gave way to talking to myself in the parking lot of Target. The likelihood of you being murdered or robbed from the car to Target and back is very low. You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. But meanwhile, I'm in Hollywood as I'm going through this process, and I'm becoming recognizable. So there's these moments where I'm literally talking to myself in the parking lot of some store, and somebody has literally T-boned me in, and I'm shaking, sweating, arm numb, and then they proceed to scream the cheers from Bring It On. But you know, I'm a good girl, so I'm like, it's already been brought in. You know, so trying to deal with post-traumatic stress syndrome, trying to function, trying to get to class, trying to figure out how to not be othered as, you know what happened, that girl. And then trying to navigate Hollywood as a young actress all at once when there's no boundaries. And if you do create boundaries, you're an asshole. You're a bad celebrity. People write blog posts about how they had shitty interactions with you.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
So how did you?
I didn't. No boundaries. I would just be shaking, you know. Randomly, I would say no. But I talk about it in the book. One time, it's very rare. Me and my former spouse were having an argument on the casino floor in Vegas. And I'm literally, you know, crying, you know, screaming the whole operation. Clearly not a good time. You wouldn't walk, excuse me. you wouldn't ask that couple for the time, much less like, and it was a cheerleading competition in the hotel. And I look up and it's a swarm of Bring It Oners, just with the bows, and they look like deranged clowns, you know. And they, you know, and they're like, bring it! And I was like, it's not a good time, girls! I'm just, you know. And then they just look so disappointed. I was like, you know, okay, I'm gonna try not to say no again. But not saying no means there's no boundaries. So self-care goes out the window. You gotta be everything to everybody at all times, which is impossible. It's impossible. I mean, and now even when I say no, people are very entitled. You were put on this earth for them in some way, shape, or form. And I recognize a lot of people want to connect, which I'm usually here for. But on occasion at, like, you know, 5 a.m. in, you know, the airport in Tuscaloosa, being jostled and, you know, grabbed by the arm. You know you want to get this selfie. Think about what it takes to get a selfie. How you have to position your body next to someone. Mind you, I've got post-traumatic stress syndrome. I've been violated. In the book I talk about, you know, someone said, you've got a lot of rape energy around you. People, things keep happening to you that you don't want to happen to you. And for some people, it's like, fuck, I just asked for a selfie. But when you think about what it physically takes to get into somebody close enough, the grabbing of someone that you don't know, full of expectation for those people, that moment is everything. I'm literally feeling like a hunted rabbit. You know, I talk a lot about, you know, have you ever seen like rabbits in your yard? And you're like, oh my God, that's a cute bunny. And then the second you go outside, they're like, I don't know. That's what it feels like inside of my body. Hmm. Like, I don't know how to escape it. And if I try to escape it, I will be called a bad celebrity. I'm not a nice woman. She was a bitch. It's like, my arm is numb.
I think about how you talk about sex and the joy that you bring to conversations about sex and the emphasis on female pleasure.
Yeah.
And then I think about what that trauma must feel like in your body. How long did it take for sex to feel good after you were raped?
Not long.
That's good. Because is that because it felt like such a fundamentally different act?
Well, it was, I mean, rape is violence. You know what I mean? And also because thank God for my soul literally was kind enough to leave my body when I was being raped. So it was almost like I was watching a movie of someone else being raped. So it's like I didn't feel that. Mm-hmm. I don't have that connection to it. And when he asked for the gun is when it's like I joined back with my body. So
he asked you to hand him
super,
the gun.
Super
just to be
sweet,
clear.
Too. Just like pass the salt. Oh, hey, hon. I know I'm violently raping you at gunpoint and all, but I actually put the gun down. Could you hand it to me? No, he was literally like, can you hand me that? Motherfucker, you about to die. Like, what? What? So it's always been very separate. And I've always looked at rape as violence, not as sex. So, and I'm really glad all of my lady parts, especially my clitoris, got that fax because, I jumped right back in. And I was more worried that I would, my ex-boyfriend at the time, I referred to him as Alex in the book, would see me as damaged or defective. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be othered. But it always separate from sexual gratification. Like I could be having a very low self-esteem, fuck moment, but I'm like, keep going. you're doing wonderful, sweetie.
As you think about the decision you made once you were famous to publicly tell this story. Like, what I didn't realize when I read your book was the crime was described in the newspaper very soon after.
Yes.
And it was described as having a black victim.
Mm-hmm. It was black, 19, from Pleasanton. Okay, well, if you're from the Tri-Valley area, wouldn't take you that long to put that together.
So do you feel
And my place of employment.
Yeah.
Everybody knows everything. I was immediately identified.
And how do you feel about that, that your ability to decide when and how to reveal that this was part of you to people in your hometown was not your choice?
That was the bit that felt the worst because I'd worked my whole life to assimilate and to disappear when necessary, to be the unseen, to not cause a problem, to you go along, you get along, you fly under the radar, unless it's for something grades or sports related. And now I've been publicly othered. Something bad has happened to you. You know, that was what I'd run from my whole life, as having, as this black body being this othered negative thing, even though I didn't ask to be raped. You were raped. Like you become that black girl. You know what I mean? And I never wanted to be that black girl. And it was that was actually the most traumatizing part. It wasn't the sexual violence for me. For someone so fully committed to assimilation, it was that was by far the most traumatizing part, the fear of being outed and who knows, and the fact that, you know, I talk about in the book that one of my, you know, former best friends went to a party and was talking about how my rape affected her, but was like using my pain as social currency, something that has carried with me through my whole career, whether that be my so-called, you know, girls, or blogs or magazines, using my pain as social currency has been a real.
How do you mean that in your career? How do you mean that people?
So, like a blog. So your social current. You're offering social commentary for clicks that then pays you, versus, you know, in my social life, if say, you know, there's that line in the song, get you some business, baby. A lot of people don't have any business. So they use your business and most certainly your pain as social currency in social settings.
And they monetize it.
You know? Hmm.
I want to skip ahead a bit to a moment when you're in your 30s, mm-hmm. after your, the end of your first marriage, and you're under the bed.
Mm, with Bubba.
Bubba, your dog, Bubba Spanx, came to investigate. You write why you were under the bed. What got you out from under the bed in that moment in your life?
His name was Bubba Sparks. I didn't Sparks. Want you guys to think of my big...
Sorry.
This Bubba dog Spanx. With, like, Spanx on. Because I got the visual. I was like...
Bubba Spanx.
Bubba Sparks after the white rapper. Because that's who he reminded
in
me
my,
of.
I read it Spanx. I've been Spanx. Picturing this little bulldog wearing Spanx running
yeah,
around.
Right. Yeah. 20 lines. Yeah, so I had hit rock bottom. I had absolutely hit rock bottom. It was, I had this trifecta of a very public failure and humiliation. Divorce, public failure, number one. My TV show, Night Stalker, got canceled. And I had this weird, random, racist incident happen that played out, like, you know, on, you know, in social media. And I just had hit rock bottom and I was under the bed and, my dog, he was the best, literally the best dog in the world. Again, I'm going to reference my girlfriend, Rachel, cause she's here. And she was like the chapter about Bubba, you know, he was literally like the most amazing dog. Everyone who came in contact with him just thought he was the dopest dog. And he somehow always knew when I was circling the drain and when I crawled under the bed, I was a hider. I don't know if anyone else hides. No, you might actually find me behind like a garbage can. Like they're like, is that ISIS behind the garbage can? Or I try to fold myself up into, you know, like small spaces, whatever. It was a thing. And I finally decided to link up with a life coach. And she had said, you know, I need you to come up with, you know, 10 things to put on your happy list. And I was, you know, we were boxing. She was also a trainer. So, you know, I'm boxing, I'm crying, I'm, you know, I'm literally rock bottom. And she's like, name stuff. And I'm like, ground beef. real butter. And imitation crab. And she was like, hold up. She grabs the bag. And she was like, did you just say imitation crab? Like, you don't even like the real fucking thing. And I was like, well, it tastes the same and it's cheaper. And she said, it's no wonder you got a divorce. You have no idea what makes you happy. How the fuck did you think someone else was going to make you happy? Hmm. That was kind of the response. Mm. That was my, like Oprah has aha moments. I have, Because it feels more like, oh, God, you dumb motherfucker. Like, you didn't, it's such common sense stuff that, like, did you really need that spelled out for you? And over time, I slowly added things to my happy list and finally started figuring out what actually made me happy. You know, one marriage in the middle of my career, you know, at times when you think you have it all together, you think by my mid-30s, I should have a general idea. And I had none. Ground beef, real butter, imitation crab. And I think there's so many of us who, if you had to say, name 10 things that make you happy, we might struggle a bit. So maybe that's your homework for tonight. Write down 10 things that make you happy.
Good homework. Also, your homework.
Have, like, imitation crab, at least, like, you know.
Go for the real crab. Yeah. Go for the real crab. We're about 5 minutes until the Q&A, so think about your questions. You write about going through IVF cycle after IVF cycle after IVF cycle in your book.
Yeah.
What did you call that chapter?
Oh, get out of my pussy.
Mm-hmm. Why did you call it that?
I felt like my pussy should be the sacrificial pussy for everyone else who's had any kind of fertility issue, who is so tired of being asked So when he wins the baby, oh, is it coming? How'd it go? Like, is like, if I wanted you to know, I would fucking tell you. Mm-hmm. Alas, I have not. So stay the fuck out of my pussy. You know, like, literally, and again, I know, you know, some of us here don't think that, you know, the Kardashians deserve basic decency, but the manhunt into, like, for, like, Kylie's bump and Khloe's, you know, like, what's in her uterus, boy or girl, tell us, and it's like, we're like the townspeople, Kardashians, we need to know, gender reveal now, it's fucking weird. And it, like, but the fact that we feel like, well, you share everything, like, we, like, you know, Khloe's been very, I mean, I don't know her. I mean, obviously, her husband, our dudes play together, but I have not had a conversation with her. But obviously, she has been very open about, you know, struggling to conceive. And when you are in the first, you know, if it's finally happened, and you're in the first, you know, trimester, you know, second trimester, this is, like, precious cargo time, like, terrified it could, you could lose this baby at any time. And the fact that she is so fucking hunted is sick. It's actually sick that we would put pregnant women in harm's way for what? What do you, I mean, they do offer a lot of information, but the one thing that they may hold back for their own safety and their child's safety and the safety of their family, we're going to literally hunt them down? You know, somewhere I'm it's like, where is the decency, collective decency? No matter what you think of them, they're human beings. If anyone in this audience has ever had any fertility issue and it's finally, you're finally pregnant, you want to put a cage around your whole body. Not only are you not telling anybody, you know, we made the mistake of telling everybody, you know, when we got pregnant the first time. And because we were so, you know, as you just, I've never seen my husband so happy. And then to have to turn around and call all those people. And then they just kept coming. You know, you start to get numb. It's like you don't even get excited anymore. You're like, well, let's just see. You know, let's just hope for the best. And it was just, it's just not happened for us. But that time of, like, do I even get hopeful? But you, again, you want to move through the world with, you know, a steel cage around you to protect yourself. And watching, you know, female celebrities be hunted during this very, you know, crucial time and delicate time, you know, emotionally, physically, it's terrifying. And I know that's to come if and when this happens for us. And that just knowing what's to come is terrifying.
So we are going to transition to the question and answer period. But I want to just start, before we do this, Gabrielle is someone who has given a lot of us permission to share, and it has been profound, and it has made us brave. If you have an urge to share, I'm afraid we won't be able to honor your story in this moment, so let's keep it focused on questions right now. But in honor of us being together, and her courage, and talking about what it is to be a survivor. If you feel like you have been harassed, if you feel like you have been violated, if you have been grabbed, if you have been raped, if you've been assaulted, and you feel comfortable, on the count of three, let's say me too together. One, two, three.
Me too.
And with that, we'll turn to questions.
Your first question is down here in the orchestra on your left.
I'm going to hold on to the microphone. Sure. It's great to be first. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Gabrielle, thank you for being here. I wanted to just hear from you about the journey that you've sort of been on into authenticity, because it's really hard
to, first of all, ask this question, but also just get up on stage and talk about things that are very personal to you. So I wanted to see, how is it that you take care of yourself? Because when you put so much out to the world, you have to be okay with what comes back.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of essays that did not make it to the book because I have not figured out how to adequately deal with those in a public setting. I'm only sharing things that I have healed from, precisely for self-care. So I strongly encourage, as everyone, you know, if you are moving in this journey towards authenticity and transparency and full freedom, and as I say again, I'm so sorry for being such a cusser, but team fuck it. honesty and accountability is crucial. So when people are like, oh, this is so different, you know, from celebrity tell-alls, I'm like, narking on my co-stars is not making me any more authentic. But sharing stories of my brutal truth, good, bad, ugly, funny, sad, that is part of my release of it. I'm firmly committed to being a different person. When you get to that place where you look in the mirror and you're like, eh. And what you get out, what you put out is exactly what you get back. Karma is a motherfucking, it's quick too, a lot of times. And I wanted to live differently. I wanted to live free of fear. Because fear had crippled me my entire life, and I wanted freedom from it. But I strongly encourage you guys to get on that journey. Don't wait until you're, 45. You can get on that journey as early as possible. And it is so freeing. And no matter what your career, what career you're in, no matter what you do, if you're a parent, if you're not a parent, if you're just a global citizen, you will move through the world in such a way that it's like there's theme music. You know, mine's usually Beyonce. But it allows you also to see people exactly as they are with very clear eyes. You're not projecting anything on them because you yourself are in a very authentic, honest, safe space within yourself. You know what I mean? And it allows for relationships to be much deeper, much more real. And the bullshit is exposed so quickly. You're not deep into a friendship where you're like, you really ain't shit. Oh. Didn't see it coming. You know, so I firmly, I strongly suggest everyone get on the path to authenticity. It is a beautiful place. The water is very warm.
Thank you for your question.
We have a question on your right over here in the back, on your right.
Hi, Gabrielle. Love you, by the way. So you've talked about how you had low self-esteem and you've gone through different traumas and PTSD and all these things. And now you seem to be this really confident, woman that knows her self-worth. But my question is, how did your younger self decide to go into a career that has such like hypervigilance and surveillance and, how did you decide to get into acting?
So my low self-esteem led me to a career where you get to be chosen. And your being chosen is very visible to millions of people. So instead of just being chosen by the clubfoot boy, I got chosen, for a production that millions of people are going to see. See, the more productions I get chosen for, I'm valuable. I'm worthy. I'm beautiful. I'm talented. But then, what happens when you don't get the job? Your ass is under the bed with your dog. So and it all started with a Tupac video. I was interning at a modeling agency as office help, as an internship while at UCLA. And as my internship was ending, one of the agents was like, do you think Gabrielle would want to audition for this Tupac video? And the man I had been auditioning or interning for was like, no, she's a serious student. She would never. And I was like, I'm sorry, what was that? I need to go in a bikini and gyrate in front of Tupac and 25 of his closest friends? I would love to. Can I bring my UCLA degree with me? I'll write an essay, perhaps. And Freud and Durkheim. But yeah, just a hot mess for many years. Many, many years. Yes.
So your next one's upstairs on your right.
Hi, Gabrielle. Thank you so much for taking my question. So I work in sexual health, and I really appreciate all the positive sexuality you talking about it. And in prevention, I think that a lot of times we as women don't have these conversations. We can have them amongst ourselves as women, but not amongst men. And how would you encourage us, as we're becoming our authentic selves, to extend that beyond to our relationships so that we're actually having authentic conversations with our partners?
I mean, you said it. This is what I like. This is what I do not like. What are you interested in? Well, that's interesting. Not me, not so much. You know, having honest conversations about boundaries and sexual expectations and safety, comfort, you know. Yes, I would like that pillow under my lower back. Thank you. That was very kind of you. But it's just communicating. And, you know, I'm two marriages in now, so perhaps I'm not the best person, or maybe I am the exact person to suggest this. Without communication, if you can't communicate your basic needs, whether those be sexual needs, financial needs, emotional needs, spiritual needs, you are in the wrong relationship. So it's a very easy way of eliminating people if they're just not into discussing it. This is obviously not going to go that far, you know. Or it'll be very one-sided. You're welcome.
We've got another question in the orchestra in the back on your left. Back on your left, downstairs, back okay, left.
Hi, Gabrielle. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I really appreciate it. My question is, I see you and Dwayne Wade in the media, and you both seem so happy. What's the secret to the both of your happiness versus your first marriage? How did you both, you know, get it right this time?
Well, we got it wrong a lot during the courtship. You know, when you shovel a lot of shit onto each other, it takes a lot of digging to get yourself out. And we had to hit rock bottom as a couple and decide, is this worth it? I love you, I like you, but this isn't healthy for either of us. And it took therapy. You know, it took being painfully accountable, for us to figure out how to love each other at the same rate, at the same time, moving in the same direction, in a happy, healthy, honest, loving way where we are supportive but also cool enough to give each other space to breathe and exist. There is no you complete me shit. It's I'm making a conscious choice to be with you every single day, because we both have a lot of options. So I'm choosing you every day. But he's my best friend. And, you know, I talk about it in the book. When I signed that prenup, he was like, I'm going to be the best, you know, I'm going to be my best self. I'm going to live my best life. And he has not looked back. I don't know if he was like secretly studying like a thesaurus. He's using different words. I don't even recognize this man. He's like, you know, they have that hashtag black boy joy. He is the epitome of that. Mm-hmm. He's a joy to be around. But I think he suffered a lot of issues with abandonment and, just a lot of issues with women that he took out on women. And he had to deal with that. And once he got a firm grasp on that and had to be accountable for that, it released him to be his most authentic self. And his most authentic self isn't the quiet, shy guy on, you know, kind of hanging on the edges of society. He's the life of the party, and he's a great freaking time. I'm going to share this story just because one of my girlfriends who was on our couple's anniversary trip is sitting in the front row. But we had this trip. We were supposed to take this boat to Mykonos, and you know, the water was too choppy, so we kind of just ended up hanging out in the water on this boat, and all the couples were out there, and Dee was like, you guys, I want to ask you, you know, the wives and one husband, because there was a gay couple, what are your expectations of us? Because we really don't know, and none of us had any examples to look up to. Mm-hmm. And when I say all the husbands' heads whipped, like, they wanted answers. And what was crazy is we'd all been married, you know, a few years even, and no one had had the conversation. So these are all steps: communication, honest, effective, specific communication. What are your expectations in this relationship? The fact that, like, half the couples said loyalty, monogamy, and they were like, oh. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. What? You know, what was a given to us, not a given to them. Not on their top 10 happy list thing. So you'd be surprised what can come out of honest conversations.
We have two more questions, one right over here.
Hi, Gabby. How are you?
Hi, good.
Thank you for being so honest. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, when you were talking about going through your list of happy things, the 10 things, was there a moment in being the woman that you are now where you just kind of looked in the mirror and were just like, I'm the shit? Like, when did you really know? Was there not like in a perfect way, but where you were just like, I feel good about who I am?
Like last year. It wasn't. Yeah, I mean, it's been a gradual thing, but as I've been on this, like, spiritual journey to be just authentic and just free myself, I really realized I put the shackles on myself, the shackles of fear, and it was choking me. I was literally being snuffed out by my own fear. And it was interesting that it just took someone suggesting that I had done that, where I was like, huh. It was one of my huh moments. And I was like, take the shackles off. Fuck, it worked. And that was just my beginning. It wasn't some big transformative moment, or it was like, at this premiere, I wore this dress and the bitch was bad. It was just, it was a slow process, and finally just being like, I don't have to live this way. And then acting on it. Behavior modification. I think a lot of us have totally identified what the problems are, but we have made no move for behavior modification or accountability. You know, you talk to some of your girlfriends that are like, and I still am dealing with this and this and this. And it's like, oh, no, what is your plan of action? Hmm? Oh, you just wanted me to, like, listen to you vent for this. Scandal is on. Like, I don't have time. I need you to have a plan of action. Let's get a poster board and put a plan of action together. I hope that answered your question.
Okay. So our final audience question is up here.
Okay.
Hi. I was wondering if you could name some of the things that make you happy now, or some of the activities that you incorporate to your routine that keep you balanced.
So my happy list now is my husband's at the top of my happy list. He is literally like the coolest, yummiest little being. My husband, animals, nature, travel, friends, beaches, cold Coronas, ice cold, I'm very specific about this, ice cold Coronas, Mexican food. See, it still goes back to food. I feel like I'm leaving. Oh, our family. Family time, kids. Don't tell them. Don't tell them. Don't go on their Snapchat and be like, she didn't even say y'all. Like, She said Mexican food like well before she said you guys. Yeah, parks. Like we do, like the things that make us the happiest have turned out to be the cheapest things, like taking a football to the park and challenging other couples randomly. It's a really good for us, it's always the element of, is that Dwayne Wade and ISIS? And they, yes, we would like to play football with you. They didn't realize it's like, Joe Montana and Jerry Rice. D has this thing. He says, throw up, mama. And I humdinger it. And it's a very good time. He runs a nice little nine route, and it's a fabulous time. And it's free. Except there's the emotional pain and toll of the other couple.
You can't take care of everybody, no. You know? So I have one more question for you before we close.
Yes.
But after this, there will be a book signing, but you can stay seated. There's going to be a process. So stay seated when the lights come up, and Gabrielle will be back out here. But the last question before we part is the question that we always ask here at Inform Events. What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Being authentic, whoever it is that you are, whatever you're into, being your most authentic self can literally change the energy of any given space. So I'd like to think if I was in the room with the NRA and I was my most authentic self and I spoke honestly and truthfully, and I was in a room full of other authentic people, we could come up with a reasonable solution that does not come out of fear. Because fear is what fuels the NRA. Fear is what fuels racism and sexism and homophobia and transphobia and discrimination against our disabled brothers and sisters and our brothers and sisters in the LGBTQ community. It's all fear and bullshit based. And you can't function in that and be authentic. So I think the more people find their authenticity and find their accountability, you will see this cultural shift that's happening right now. I think we're finding more and more people as they find their voice and they find their authentic self, finding the power to speak and act. And you're seeing real change, and we're seeing it daily. I think we're at a very interesting place in time, and I think everyone is capable of these 60-second world solutions. If we practice them, actively practice them daily, I think we're unfucking stoppable.
Thank you to the Commonwealth Club, Inform at the Commonwealth Club, for hosting us. Thank you to all of you for being here. I'm Anna Sale, and this is Gabrielle Union.
Thank you so much. Thank you.